Our fifth case for argument this morning is United States against Reed. Mr. Meyer.
May it please the court, John Meyer on behalf of the defendant Mark Reed. The case involves or starts with a traffic stop on I-57 on July 17th of the year 2000. Mr. Reed was in a vehicle with two other occupants. He was a passenger. The other occupants were the driver and owner of the vehicle. This vehicle was stopped by an Illinois State trooper for going 8 miles over the limit by an officer assigned to a drug interdiction unit. After the traffic stop and the issuance of a warning ticket and a ticket to the driver for not having proper driver's license, the officer obtained consent to search the vehicle. A later search at a state police weigh station revealed the presence of two bundles of cash. And thereafter, Mr. Reed, along with the other two occupants, were then transported to the Illinois State Police Headquarters for the purpose of interrogation. As a result of that interrogation, Mr. Reed ultimately confessed to being involved in a marijuana smuggling scheme.
Mr. Mark, didn't the police have probable cause to arrest Mr. Reed once they discovered the trash compartment in the trailer and the money bundled in the cellophane? I mean, isn't that pretty much all that's required under Carrillo?
If there was probable cause, but I would submit to the court, there is not the remotest possibility that there was probable cause as to Mr. Reed. He was a mere passenger in the vehicle. There was no indication that he had any knowledge of what was in the trailer or should have had knowledge of what was in the trailer. The evidence was not particularized as to Mr. Reed giving the police probable cause to arrest him.
Well, you've got a hidden compartment in a horse trailer with $94,000 in two bundles wrapped in pink cellophane. The state trooper knew that Reed had been arrested for narcotics. His story conflicts with Mr. Martin. And, you've got I-57 with the narcotics. People running up and down it like every other road in America.
Well, that's news to me. I assume that under that scenario, just about every interstate is a drug route.
See, it doesn't pass the straight-faced test for me.
But in any case,
how about the rest of it?
But in addressing Your Honor's concerns, first of all, as far as inconsistent stories, when the occupants were first questioned, I think it was Martin said they had bought some horses and were on their way to Texas. When Reed was questioned separately, he added the fact that Martin was finalizing his divorce in Illinois and also had some medical problems that were being treated. So I would not concede that there's any inconsistencies to the extent that it would give an officer probable cause to arrest somebody. And as this court has held, the presence of a large amount of cash, even in an unusual location, is not sufficient to provide probable cause. And I would say to this court that taking all of the circumstances present at the weigh station into account, there was not probable cause to arrest Mr. Reed.
What should they have done? Let him go?
Let him go. They should have said, I mean, if there was any probable cause that might have existed as to either Martin, the owner of the vehicle, or the driver of the vehicle, but Garnica, but to include Reed, who was just sitting in the back seat doing nothing, I think was entirely improper and unjustified.
They couldn't infer that he was part of a common enterprise?
I don't see how. I don't see any facts that link Reed to the cash or to any improper or illegal conduct.
Are you going to are you conceding that there was enough to hold the other people?
I wouldn't even concede that much. Again, presence of cash, you could have $1 million in a hidden compartment. And by the way, it was under the floorboard. It wasn't like one of these fabricated stash boxes you see in cars where they've drilled out the...
It was a fabricated cash box in a horse trailer.
Well, what they do is...
Did that really help your guy out?
Right. Well, what they did is they lifted a couple of floorboards and put the cash right under there. It's not like they went to any great effort. And if anybody's carrying cash, well, of course you want it concealed or hidden. I don't think that's unusual.
From the horses?
What was that, Your Honor?
From the horses?
No, from anybody that, say, if you're transporting a large amount of cash, which is entirely legitimate, and you don't want to be robbed, you want somebody to discover the cash it isn't entitled to.
Are there any people who carry $90,000 in cash concealed on the floorboards of horse trailers for, quote, entirely legitimate purposes?
I would suggest so.
Who are those people?
Well, just as this court ruled that in $506,000, where they had money was in a dumbwaiter in a barrel, the court said, so what? Cash? Even large amounts in an unusual...
What are the normal business transactions facilitated by $90,000 in cash hidden in the floorboards of a horse trailer?
Some people deal in cash. Mm-hmm. Some people need to transport cash.
Some people deal in cash in order to engage in tax evasion. That doesn't sound good.
No, I mean, but there can be legitimate reasons, too. I don't think this court... You can assume illegitimate reasons.
People who have legitimate reasons to transport large amounts of cash usually give them to Wells Fargo or Brinks rather than horse trailers.
That could very well be. I'm not going to doubt that would be the more practical and prudent means of transporting cash. But on the other hand, you can't imply illegal conduct from the circumstances of having cash itself.
I think during the unpleasantness of the 1973-74 season, when it was pointed out that a lawyer had received maybe this amount of cash in a brown paper bag, that was thought to be highly incriminating. Have times changed so much?
I'm not familiar with that case, Your Honor.
It had to do with defense funds for the plumbers in the Watergate investigation.
Oh.
Delivered surreptitiously on a bridge to an alleged defense lawyer. Actually, at the time, he was in good standing at the bar. His standing was somewhat diminished by the nature of this transaction.
But I assume there were other circumstances, because for an attorney to accept cash, even large amounts, doesn't imply illegal conduct. As long as he deposits the cash or reports the cash as far as his tax obligation.
But even if we assume, let's say we would assume that his arrest was improper, wouldn't his own testimony that he decided to look for his own self-interest and cooperate with the police sufficient evidence showing that, you know, any taint from any possible improper arrest would be purged?
No, Your Honor, and I think what you have to look at, if you look at the circumstances leading up to his decision to voluntarily cooperate and make a statement, he had been in custody maybe 6 hours at that point. He had been interrogated twice, had denied involvement, and it was only while he was being fingerprinted, which is normally the step before you're jailed or incarcerated, that he decided to cooperate. And obviously his state of mind at that point was, well, I'm going to be jailed, I'm going to be charged with a crime concerning this cash, I better make the best of my situation here. And that's what prompted him to cooperate and make a confession, not out of the fact that all of a sudden there was a spontaneous and voluntary act by the defendant independent from the illegal arrest. And as I just mentioned, there had been two prior interrogations of Mr. Reed. Had, in fact, the police been acting in good faith without an improper motive, why not release him after he had denied twice his involvement in any illegal conduct? But they continued their interrogation, proceeded with the fingerprinting, which ultimately caused Mr. Reed to confess to an involvement in a marijuana smuggling scheme. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer.
Thank you.
Mr. Wiseman.
May it please the Court, David Wiseman on behalf of the United States. To pick up on several points that were raised, the issue of probable cause, I think, is worth further exploring. Mr. Meyer offers several explanations as to why someone might be carrying that amount of cash in the horse trailer. I think most significantly, a point that, for I think obvious reasons, Mr. Meyer does not raise, is that the occupants of the vehicle were asked, are there any contraband, guns, or money? The driver says, no. Once you find the cash, which maybe there was a legitimate reason, maybe they chose not to use Wells Fargo or whatever other commercial establishment.
I believe one of them gave an explanation which was not entirely believable.
Correct. They stated that it was an inheritance, which is a legitimate source of the income, but that raises the question of why they didn't just say that to begin with, if that in fact was the case.
But inheritances don't usually come in cash. They usually come in
checks
or some other form from the executor of an estate.
Correct. And I agree with that, and again, by not disclosing it and then finding it in a place that was hidden, I agree with Mr. Meyer's characterization that was not a sophisticated hiding place, but it was a place in the gooseneck of a trailer that was very difficult to get to if
you were
going to use it.
What did you have charged him with at that point?
There was probable cause to believe that he had possession of money from an illegal source.
That's a crime?
The possession...
That's enough to arrest a man on?
It's probably...
You got some money, you can't explain where it's from, we're going to arrest you. That's what they had.
The issue is probable cause. Reasonable, mm-hmm. articulable belief of illegal activity. Now, the exact crime...
You can hold him on that?
I'm sorry?
You can hold him on that, we'll figure out what the illegal activity is down the road.
It's a basis to hold someone and further investigate, yes.
Just probable like cause?
Yes, reasonable, articulable basis to believe some illegality occurred, just as if you had found someone with a bloody knife outside of a room where someone had been screaming. Now, you don't know that someone's been stabbed inside the room, but you have reasonable, articulable basis to believe that something happened. Maybe there's a butcher, maybe they had killed a chicken and you misheard what was going on in the room, but the question is there a reasonable, articulable basis to hold that person and further investigate? That's what the officers did.
Sounds to me like we can now hold people. That's all about Terry stuff, right?
Well, it's a seizure. I would
agree.
We're
talking about arresting somebody because there is incriminating evidence or evidence that possibly could be incriminating. That's basis for an arrest now. That's what the government's arguing today.
It's a seizure. It is a seizure, and that seizure could be dissipated or it could be increased. It is a seizure. Now,
you're really asking for quite an expansion of your authority just to put people on ice.
Well, let me
you have to go to a magistrate with this guy real fast now, right? You've arrested him.
Let me make...
What are you going to tell a magistrate?
Let me make clear the posture of this case. The district court assumed a Fourth Amendment violation. The government is not arguing today that issue needs to be resolved. The issue is whether the statements later were admissible, whether there was an attenuation.
No, if I may, sir, that's another point that bothers me about this quite a bit. The methodology of the district court was rather unique here.
Mm-hmm.
The district court relied on the third prong of the Brown exception.
Correct.
Okay. And said that here, because of there was no real government overbearing, et cetera, there was no real taint to the statement. Can she really make that determination on that third rung of the Brown exception without having determined the issue of probable cause?
Absolutely. The Brown analysis presumes that there's been an improper Fourth Amendment seizure. The question is whether that's been attenuated. The district court did exactly that. She said, I assume this arrest is improper. Looking at all the factors that the Supreme Court's told me to look at, was the statement 6 hours later a byproduct of that unlawful Fourth Amendment seizure? So whether or not the seizure that occurs, whether it be a seizure or not, that occurred on I-57 was proper or not, the district court was correct and proper in deciding the Fourth Amendment issue in the context of Brown.
The Lefebvre treatise makes the point, though, that in assessing that third prong, one of the things you really ought to focus on is just how close a call the probable cause issue is. Okay? To the degree that it was a close call, that an officer in the heat of the moment having to make a judgment out, on the shoulder of a road, makes a judgment. That close judgment call may very well influence whether or not there's been a taint to the statement.
Correct.
So my problem is, if you're going to abstain on just how close a call that original determination was, do you really have before you all of the evidence you need to determine that third prong?
As far as the extent of the stain, the district court had that evidence, and she with particularity went through and looked at the conflicting stories. To go back to your original issue about just having money in a concealed compartment, in the Carrillo case, this court said an empty concealed compartment.
I was on that case, and one of the distinguishing characteristics there is that there had been shadowing of these guys. The officers knew there was an ongoing operation. I think they had a dozen vehicles, all which had gone into the shop, all had this thing made. I mean, this was an ongoing business, and the police officers knew that. We don't have that here. Here we've got he's going a little bit over the speed limit. We pull him over out down here on the highway.
And I argued the Carrillo case to this court. There were six vehicles, and the people who were stopped they hadn't been individualized. Each of the people stopped. Some were. But all the people stopped were not linked to this ongoing activity. The issue in the case was whether the stop of the vehicle was based on probable cause. This court said an empty, and I will concede a more sophisticated empty concealed compartment, along with the other circumstances which the court has mentioned, was sufficient for a stop, a probable cause stop. Getting back to the bigger picture of this case is, you're asking, did the district court properly analyze it, assuming a Fourth Amendment violation? I think it's appropriate. I think it was an effort of judicial economy without needing to resolve these other factual disputes. I think the most important factor, though, as this court has articulated, is, was it a voluntary statement? Was this confession, was it a byproduct of a Fourth Amendment violation, or was it a decision that the individual made? In this case, it's clear.
Well, there is a difference, though, isn't there, between a voluntariness analysis and a Brown analysis?
I think voluntariness, well, first of all, I have a little issue with how the district court looked at it. One, under Brown, voluntariness is a requirement. There's no issue that his statement was voluntary.
The threshold requirement.
Right.
That's right.
And there's no issue that it was voluntary. The district court, I take issue somewhat with the way she analyzed it, because voluntariness also goes to his motivation. He decided to cooperate in an interest of helping himself. That's undisputed. That does go to voluntariness, but I think it's also an intervening circumstance that goes strongly to the issue of whether this statement was a product of a Fourth Amendment violation or a statement that's done attenuated of that.
Mr. Weissman, you've been very helpful. I've got one more area maybe you can help me out here. Some of our cases interpreting Brown have said the way to identify the Brown kind of situation is if the police, in effect, are holding somebody because they don't have enough really to proceed, and they're hoping something will turn up. This is the language the cases use. Can't the facts here be characterized that way? You'd have a tough time going to a magistrate with what you had from the side of the road on this guy. But if we hold him a while, you know, we don't quite treat him as a prisoner, but we hold him for a while, we separate these guys, we play good cop, bad cop, something's going to turn up and we'll have enough to go before the black rope. Don't we have here the classic Brown situation?
I would disagree with that. I think the classic Brown situation is more the case where an officer goes out and grabs someone in hopes of getting a confession as a result of the improper Fourth Amendment seizure. I see my time's up. If you want,
please,
I can...
Please complete your answer.
If the issue is, I think the classic Brown case is when that seizure is kind of thought out to say, let's grab him and see what the guy says. That, I think, is a classic Brown case. This is nothing like that. This was a traffic stop, a voluntary consent to search, an uncovering of evidence that doesn't quite make sense. Everyone was brought back, and they were interviewed in non-custodial, non-interrogative ways, and eventually something did come up. But I don't see this case as falling into the concern the Supreme Court and this Court has articulated in the Brown context, where someone is seized for Fourth Amendment purposes in hopes of gaining a confession. It's
even helpful.
Time.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Wiseman. Mr. Meyer, we held Mr. Wiseman over, so if you'd like an extra minute for rebuttal, you're welcome to it.
If I could make one point, Your Honor.
Certainly.
And that is, in response to Mr. Wiseman's argument that Mr. Reed's statement was voluntary and therefore that's an intervening circumstance, I would just suggest to this court, and Mr. Wiseman's statement that it was self-motivation that Mr. Reed confessed, I would suggest to this court that everybody that confesses is self-motivated to somehow gain an advantage for themselves. So I would submit to the court that that's of no moment in this appeal. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Meyer. And Mr. Meyer, we appreciate your willingness to undertake the appointment and the assistance you've been to your client and to the court, too. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.